Welcome to Parents' Perspective. I guess boys are just better at math, Diane sighed, looking at 11-year-old Katie's dismal math grade. You know that's not true, snapped her friend Trina. So what did you do with Kevin that made him good at math? Diane looked forlorn. I've done worksheets with Katie, and we even got her a tutor. She shook her head. She just doesn't seem to get it. Trina looked into her coffee cup. I'm not sure it was anything special we did. In a way, it might have been what we didn't do. Huh? Diane looked up. Well, he did all the normal stuff, like playing with blocks and Legos and all those little cars. He still seems to enjoy helping with the cooking. And he's gotten so he can figure out how to double the recipes. So I guess that's sort of math. But what about worksheets or workbooks or at least those terrific educational computer games? Diane asked. Nah, Trina shook her head. Kevin was always too busy figuring out how to line up his best goal kick to do all that stuff. From a parent's perspective, how can we best prepare our children for mathematical competence? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest was educated with and is now a teacher of hands-on math. Sarah Harriman has worked as an English as a second language tutor, special education teacher in mathematics, middle school math specialist, and high school math teacher. Recently, she returned to the Washington, D.C. area to teach at her own alma mater, the Washington Waldorf School. Her experience as a Waldorf student and teacher deeply informs her perspective on experiential learning and meeting the physical, emotional, and intellectual needs of today's children. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
As a middle school and high school math teacher, when you look back, what would be a student's optimum preparation for success in mathematical literacy?
When you look at the skills that are needed for competence in upper-level mathematics, whether you're thinking middle school or high school or even college, it's less an ability to develop skills and it's more about having core concepts. So if you think about having a real sense of number, not memorizing necessarily the timetables, but really knowing what a number represents, what it means, what the relationship of 56 is to 7 and 8, and how those connect. And this doesn't come from the sort of rote memorization of times tables. This comes from the experience of developing a sense of sequencing, a sense of quantity. And this comes from experiencing the physical world as a young child and relating to your toys and cleaning up. P.S., by the way, is a significant
– wow.
Yeah. Cleaning up chores are one of the places where children, I think, develop a lot of concrete connection with the key concepts of mathematics.
Can you give some examples of that? Everybody's rubbing their hands in glee.
Thinking, oh, hooray. Well, think of your living room strewn with toys. Yeah? Where do they go? They go back in their locations. You sort and organize. The blocks go here. You're categorizing. You're putting things back where they belong. You're putting like with like. You're developing key concepts of category, similarity, shared qualities. You're also in the routine of cleaning up, having children be responsible for that. You're not only developing a sense of first I do this and then I do this, this beautiful picture of sequencing, you're also developing an ability in the child to do things on his or her own. The number one thing that's important when you move into upper level mathematics is having an ability to do something on your own, to think for yourself, to be an investigator, and not just sort of wait for the answer to come to you, but rather to ask a question, ponder that question, and really think for yourself. I see many children struggling with that now, that inner confidence in their own abilities.
Are there certain ages and stages where these concrete experiences are especially important?
I would say yes and no. I think concrete learning experience in mathematics informs your study from learning how to add numbers to going through geometric proofs later in high school. That being said, the early years, you know, a young child sort of birthed through 5 or 6, It should all be concrete. There is no need to be abstracting the instruction for them at that point.
So people who buy the video games and the computer games that are educational, that show you can have four pencils and you take away two pencils and all that kind of stuff, that's not very helpful?
I would say no. I think there's more and more evidence coming out that that's actually very detrimental to a child's brain development, their intellectual development, their social development.
And why would that be detrimental to the brain development?
I am not a neuroscientist, but, you know, I think to myself, here you have a small child, 3 or 4 years old, you are giving them basically an interface system. So they're not actually learning about four pencils that are there, that are pencils. They're learning through a picture of a pencil on an interface system. You're asking them to negotiate so many levels of abstraction and teaching them that a pencil isn't a pencil. It's the idea of a pencil. But, I mean, this is almost an existential question. This is not a four-year-old question. Give them the pencils. Let them play with blocks, marbles, cars. I mean, give them the stuff. And they will start to develop a sense of quantity. They really will. You see this with children in social play, the learning to share, gathering all the toys around them. They need to have all of them, developing this sense of, oh, I could have one and you could have one. It emerges naturally out of play. The sense of quantity.
It's interesting. We have been doing some reading over the past gazillion years, and one author in particular, who I believe is a neuroscientist, Jane Healy, talked about the chemical rewiring that actually happens physically when young children are having the concrete experiences, the tactile experiences rewire the brain.
That makes sense to me. You know, as an observer of children, you see that when children are learning, there is so much activity that comes through their hands. We all know that babies learn about the universe by putting stuff in their mouth and by touching it, grabbing things. And this doesn't stop when a baby becomes two. They're still in that phase of really learning through experiencing their world. And I think that's our job as teachers and parents, to provide an environment that's rich with experience. And I don't mean, you know, educational games, video games, et cetera, which I would say more and more evidence is going to continue to come out that this is actually the worst thing you could do for your child.
Children count, and that's playing to them.
Yeah.
I have six blocks, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 here. I'll give you two.
Yeah.
Well, then the question is, how many do I have left?
Yeah.
They figure this out, but it's all play to them. They don't have to know. They don't have to intellectualize what the concept is.
Not at all. Not at all. It's important actually to not intellectualize it for the young child. Let it remain in play. And if they're counting in sequence that's not right, that's okay.
Oh, yeah.
It will
it's
come.
It's cute.
And it's interesting, the ubiquitous cardboard box, you know, the thing that the game came in, is the toy that's most exciting. And you can sort of see what you were talking about, how things fit. The child could climb in. Does the child fit? What else fits? The whole idea of sort of geometric literacy seems to be coming in a very quiet way.
Very quiet way. And the other piece that I think is important very much for mathematics is having the ability to imagine things vividly. As you move into sort of the abstraction of mathematics in the upper grades, you have to be able to really imagine these relationships, because on paper they're very abstracted. And what you allow a child to develop when you're young and you give them things like a cardboard box or blocks or Legos or, you know, a train set that they set up or, you know, a play kitchen, is you're asking them to engage their imagination and to sort of breathe life into the toys. And that quality of having a vivid imagination serves you in good stead as an adult also and as a learner through life.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on hands-on math.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Sarah Herrmann about hands-on math.
Let's talk for a minute about the school where you teach. What is the actual philosophy at the Washington Waldorf School and other schools that are like that?
This is a difficult question to answer in a nutshell. So Waldorf education is a developmentally based curriculum and pedagogy. based upon the philosophies of Rudolf Steiner, an Austrian philosopher from the early 1900s, late 1800s. When we say it's a developmentally based education, it means that we're really looking at the age of the child and seeing where are they in terms of their learning styles. The picture that we have is one that really looks at the birth through 6, 7 as a phase, 6 through 12, 14 as a phase, and sort of 12, 14 in there through 18, 19 years old. So these are kind of the three phases that we're thinking of. This first phase we're really looking at, this is a place where a child is in the preschool ages. They're learning through imitation and through play. In that sense, we have a totally play-based early childhood program. There's no explicit instruction, though there's all kinds of implicit instruction through circle time and storytelling. And all of the toys are what we would describe as open-ended. The toys that many of us recognize from our childhoods, you know, blocks, figures, very sort of nondescript figures, cloths, play stands, big blocks of wood so they can build forts, things like
so
that.
So there's not a right or a wrong way to play with these toys.
At all. The key element here is that there is a million different ways to play with these toys, and that's the essential element.
And I'm assuming they're not battery operated and flashing lights and lots of buttons.
It's quite remarkable when you walk into a Waldorf kindergarten, all the toys are natural materials. It has a very distinctive look to it. You know, all these toys have very natural textures. It's full sensory integration, the materials in the classroom. There is also all kinds of what I would describe as sort of home activities, baking, cooking. The children wash the dishes that they have snack on. You know, these kinds of chores that are part of daily life are part of the life of the early childhood program. So that kind of gives you a sense of the first phase. The second phase, this kind of 6, 7 through 12, 14, this is what we would describe as the elementary middle school years. This, in our picture of the developing child, is where they're really learning through their emotional intelligences. This is where children, their friendships are becoming more and more strong. They're developing a real social connection at this point in their lives. And so we try and meet that in a number of different ways. One of the things that happens in a Waldorf school that's quite different than other schools is you'll have the same teacher from first through eighth grade. You'll have other teachers also, your movement teachers, your language teachers, etc. But your classroom teacher is the same person. I've had many people ask me, well, what happens if you don't like your teacher? I always say, well, first graders always like their teacher, and eighth graders always think that they're, you know, the most annoying person on the planet. What that relationship does is it lets you see how that's developmental, that having a real emotional close love for your teacher in first grade is totally appropriate. And creating real distance with authority figures in eighth grade and starting to say, no, I don't like you anymore, I don't agree with you anymore, is developmentally appropriate because it's not personality driven. It's the same person you loved 8 years ago. The other thing that we do at that point is while instruction becomes direct at that point and explicit in terms of learning to read, learning the math skills, the different algorithms, adding, subtracting, etc., the teacher always tries to imbue it with a real sense of story, narrative, and human quality. One of the things I remember from my first grade year is learning about the math processes. And my teacher told this incredible story about the big fat Mrs. Plus and how she liked to collect all of the jewels, and she collected everything. And then the sad Mr. Minus, and he had a hole in his back pocket. And so things always fell out of his pocket. He was always losing things. And, you know, sort of the story goes on. And then out of that, you form a real kind of a sense of these processes, not just being an abstraction, but having human qualities to them. This would be inappropriate for a 16-year-old, but for a 6 or 7-year-old, it's magical. It's really wonderful. I think that this is one of the things that we can do to make math more interesting is really bring our imaginations into it to make it alive.
When children don't have direct instruction in mathematical concepts in their early years of schooling, don't they lag behind children who do have the more traditional formal instruction?
I would say that the latter is actually the case, that the children who have an experiential context to their early math education have the ability to move forward in mathematics in a much more significant way in the later years.
Because they have the concepts under their belt?
They have the concepts in their bodies. They have an intuitive sense of things. You know, it's not all abstraction. So that when you get to learning different number bases, where you're no longer working with a base 10, let's say you're working with a binary system or a base 8 system, which is very difficult to wrap your mind around because it's so antithetical to sort of what we feel in our bodies. If you don't feel that in your body, it becomes so difficult to hold on to the abstract idea. The other thing that is also true is that what happens when you start to do direct instruction at a very early age, children, in my opinion, aren't ready for that. So what you're really doing is you're training them. And what training is not creating a lifelong learner. Training someone to repeat a task over and over again is not education. That's pushing a button. That's following a step the same way before again and again and again.
It's like the old business of, can you teach a monkey to type?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's that very same picture. You can train almost anyone to do almost anything. That's the last thing you want to do in mathematics. You want your child to be an investigator. You want them to know the questions to ask. And that's a very different ability that you can't train someone to do. And that what happens with these really sort of intense, rote, kind of master your math facts kind of approaches for the young child is it instills in them a sense that they can train themselves. And then they can just do it. And they don't have to think. They can follow the pattern. And later in life, later in math, by fifth, sixth grade, it doesn't work anymore. You can't train yourself to do upper-level algebra. You can't train yourself because there's just too many things to remember. You need to be able to figure out what to do when. That's a question-asking activity. That's not a category thing. That would mean all the teachers would have to say, have a topic at the top of every math set and say, this is what this is about. Follow the pattern. This is what this is about. Follow the pattern. That's not what a math test looks like. That's not what math looks like. You know, you have a problem and you have to solve it. It's problem solving.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on hands-on math.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Sarah Hairman about hands-on math.
So one of the things that's happening in math instruction and in education in general is this idea of earlier is better. You know, we see this everywhere. This to me seems really the wrong direction to be going. And the best anecdote I have for this is if you think about learning to ride a two-wheeler. If you try and teach a two-year-old to ride a two-wheeler, you will not be successful. But if you wait till a child is 6, 7 years old, maybe 8, you can learn to ride a two-wheeler in an afternoon. I know this. I taught my sister how to ride her bike. We ran up and down the street 3 times, and she was off. And that, I think, is a perfect picture of when you meet a child at the right moment with the right thing, they can just run with it.
Sarah, how can schools, other than Waldorf schools, best use this kind of information in developing their curricula and their in-class experiences?
Waldorf schools are not the only schools doing hands-on math instruction. Many, many schools are doing this. More and more people are recognizing that this training model isn't working and wanting to really give children concrete experiences. So this is not a revolutionary – well, maybe it is a revolutionary idea. But it's a revolutionary idea that's caught on.
Doesn't come with batteries.
It doesn't come with batteries, yeah. One idea that I had that I was thinking that is done so well in the Waldorf school is that the children really make their manipulatives. And that, I think, is a way that any school can do that. You know, when you're learning place value, having the children's popsicle sticks, you know, glue the 10 beans on the popsicle stick or work with little bags so that you really can borrow. That's one of the things I was thinking about, sort of the traditional math manipulatives. When you borrow, it's like you have to swap out. If you have a little bag of 10, you can pull a stone out, and you really can borrow. And having the children really own their tools that way, they can use them in a way that's very engaging. And I think that it's, you know, yes, it takes time, and you think, oh, well, I don't have enough time for direct instruction. But by imbuing the tools with the children's own creativity, I think your teaching would be so much more successful. I think that's just one simple way to do it.
We were talking before the show about an interesting way of teaching math concepts in the first grade in the school that you happen to be at. You want to explain that a little bit?
One of the things that happens at a Waldorf school is that there is lots of time in the day for non-academic instruction. In the first grade, we teach the children how to knit. I have taught many people how to knit, children and adults. You'd be surprised how easy it is for children and how challenging it is for adults. That being said, the activity of knitting is an activity of crossing the midsection. This is a benchmark that early childhood development professionals look at. Children's ability to cross the midline is a reflection of appropriate brain development going on.
The midline of their own bodies.
Of their own bodies, yes.
Using a balance.
It's the left and right side of the brain. It shows an integration of the two sides of the brain. And the activity of knitting is an activity of integrating the two sides of the brain, which is an essential component of learning to read, of integrating the two sides of the brain. It doesn't appear that you're teaching reading at that point. What you are is you're developing a skill that will serve them in good stead, developing a capacity in the children through teaching knitting.
So then you have little six-year-olds with a product they've produced and all kinds of knowledge they've gotten.
It's incredible.
Knitting.
And
they
when
have
you see
to count, right?
You have to count, keep track of your rows. You make mistakes. You have to take it out and fix it. The qualities that the children are learning through such an activity in terms of being a student, being a human being in the world, are immeasurable.
It's interesting, too, because we would like our kids all to have perseverance. That seems to be a major quality in being able to be successful in academia or whatever. And it would seem to me that if you're learning how to knit, you know, stitch by stitch by stitch, you have to learn that.
You do have to learn that. And one of the things that I think is significant about developing perseverance in our children is that they need to produce something that is cherished, not just a worksheet that gets filed or something. But when you knit something, often, you know, the children will make a hot mat or, you know, a washcloth or a bag for their mom or, you know, something that's used. They'll knit cases for their pencils or they'll crochet a case for their recorder or something like that, something that is then cherished and used year after year after year. And that, in terms of creating a reward for perseverance, is significant. There needs to be a concrete product. We all know that children respond positively when we take a picture that they've done and we put it up on the refrigerator. This is so important for them, to see that we respect their work and that it's important to us. It's that same idea of creating something that is then cherished.
What can parents do to support a child's awareness of mathematical concepts without turning play into a math lesson?
That would be the worst thing, wouldn't it? That would ruin everything. There is absolutely no need to intellectualize and make explicit children's play when they're young. You really can just let them play. Provide them materials and opportunities to play. I think free time is really important. Less scheduling. The children should have free time every day just to play in their homes, in their backyards, in their apartments, wherever they are, just to play. And that, I think, develops all of the necessary capacities, concepts that they'll need for further math literacy later in life.
There are all kinds of wonderful bath toys that are on the market. And we've discovered at our house with the grandchildren, the best math toys are the measuring spoons and measuring cups that come right out of my kitchen and get carried up to the bathtub.
They're perfect in the bathtub. That's all you really want, empty shampoo bottles and measuring cups. And now that we have all these things made in plastic, it's totally safe in the tub. The tub, I think, is probably a place where really important science and math concepts are developed early on.
What resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to learn more about some of the issues we've been discussing and we're running out of time?
Well, I think that for people who are looking for really practical ways to implement some sort of hands-on math experiences, a publishing company called Griffin House has a number of different texts that have very simple early childhood activities that a parent or a teacher could implement easily into their classroom. Simple, simple things. And I think they have a number of texts that are worth recommending. There is a man named Jamie York, who is a Waldorf teacher, who has developed a curriculum that Waldorf schools are using, a lot of homeschool movements are using, that's called Making Math Meaningful, where there's this real sense of connecting the children with the deeper meaning of mathematics. So it is more concrete. It's more satisfying. For anybody who would like to learn more about Waldorf education in general, there is a book entitled Understanding Waldorf Education by Jack Petrasch that gives a very straightforward overview of what we're doing in the Waldorf school. The website of OSNA, www.awsna.org, OSNA is the National Organization of Waldorf Schools. It stands for Association of Waldorf Schools of South and North America. And that is a great resource for anybody who's interested in learning more about Waldorf education, how to start a Waldorf school, how to implement certain qualities into the school that you have. There are Waldorf schools. There are schools inspired by Waldorf methods. These ideas are coming into the educational world.
Well, you have certainly given us a whole lot of ideas and insights into a kind of education that it sounds like we all need to be more aware of. So, Sarah Harriman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. I very much enjoyed myself.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 424 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the SF Foundation. Our sound engineer is Elizabeth Buckle. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.